Chapter 44. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake Foothills, March 15, 2012, Day 11. The cabin sat at the edge of the forest, and the dying evening light cast it in an ominous glow. A creek crawled around from the back and cascaded over three tiers of staircase rocks before trickling into a large pond at the side of the cabin. Cattails swayed in a gentle breeze, and other than the gurgle of the water and a few bird calls, it was quiet and still this far out. "It looks empty," Ray said, staring through the windshield. There were no lights on, and no vehicles parked near the cabin. With the passenger side door open, Kelsey shook her head, tapped her phone, and played the message one more time. She put her phone on speaker. Back in Ray's apartment, Kelsey had spoken with Brad Reynolds' father, who told her he and his son were not on speaking terms and that Brad was no longer part of his life. But soon after Kelsey ended the call, and while she was attempting to reach Richard Walker, Brad's mother had called and left a message. Kelsey and Ray listened to it again now.
"Hello? This is Diane Reynolds, Brad's mother. You just spoke with my husband. Sorry for his rudeness. He and Brad are going through a rough time, that's all. Brad is still very much part of our family, and he did know the girl who died. They went to school together. And I'm sure he'd be willing to talk to you about Becca. He's staying at our hunting cabin about an hour outside of Summit Lake. If you see him, tell him we love him very much, and that we asked him to call home." Kelsey and Ray listened once more to Mrs. Reynolds' directions. They were sure this was the cabin. They climbed out and walked to the front porch. Kelsey took the three steps slowly. Dried and crumbled leaves, once bright and colorful, were now black and brittle and accumulating in the corners of the porch. "Brad Reynolds," Kelsey called out. "Are you home?" Kelsey walked across the porch and noticed the front door was open. She squinted her eyes and peeked inside. "Hello?" When she got no answer, she pushed the door open. Blue, dusky light spilled through the windows and cast the interior in a grainy hue. The cabin was a cluttered mess. A couch by a fireplace, and an ancient makeshift television with bunny ear antennae. A desk and a chair covered with scattered newspapers. Newspapers stacked everywhere. Kelsey cocked her head slightly when she saw it. The purse, resting on the end table, with its coach insignia and smooth leather, looked out of place in the dingy cabin. Her instincts kicked in, and Kelsey walked through the doorway and into the dark cabin. Chapter 45. Brad Reynolds, Summit Lake, February 17, 2012, the night of Becca's death. Brad stood over Becca's motionless body, his chest heaving like an asthmatic. He stood while minutes passed, chasing his breath, not sure exactly what he had just done or what he should do next. He quickly looked around the stilt house, which was trashed from the mudroom to the kitchen to the family room, where he stood, like a mini tornado had spun its way through the house. He ran to the kitchen and picked up Becca's coach purse from the floor. An envelope was next to it, and he grabbed that also. There were other things he should do: unlock a door, or break a window, or go upstairs and take her mother's jewelry. But the thoughts descended on him in an avalanche of panic. Instead, he ran with Becca's purse to the sliding glass door, looking at her still, naked body once more, before pulling the door open and running into the night. The cold winter air entered his lungs and stung his eyes. He had parked his truck on a side street off Maple. After he ran the length of the dock, past all the stilt houses, he pulled up and began to walk. The last thing he needed was someone to remember a man running through the streets tonight. When he reached his truck, he grabbed the handle and looked up and down the street. He was alone. He pulled the door open and climbed in, throwing the purse on the passenger seat next to him. Bringing his breathing under control, he started the truck and put it in gear. 5 minutes later, he pulled out of the town center and drove the dark mountain roads that would take him back to his father's hunting cabin. He turned on his high beams, and his mind went blank. Before he was aware of his actions, and without being able to recall anything about the hour's drive, Brad was taking the final switchback,
the headlights illuminating the cabin as he approached. His eyes were unblinking when he killed the engine. He sat for many minutes as the truck cooled in the night air, ticking every so often. Finally, he grabbed Becca's purse from the passenger seat and walked through the beam of the headlights and into the cabin. Leaving the door open, the truck's headlights spilled through the doorframe as he sat on the couch. He held the purse close to his chest, clutching it like a child's teddy bear. He blinked just in time for tears to roll down his cheeks. In front of him, on the wooden coffee table, were the items he had doted over before deciding to drive into town and see her. Pictures of Becca from school, when she wore cut-off jeans and a GWU t-shirt bunched and held with a rubber band at her side. A photo of the two of them at an Orioles game when Becca visited the summer after freshman year. The notes she used to leave on his nightstand when she stayed the night and left before he woke. There were dozens of them. B, see you tonight at the 19th. You're cute when you snore. B. The stolen business law test also rested on the table. In so many ways, that test was what sent his life spiraling. He had to know the truth. If she really needed him to steal it for her, or if it was all a play. He had gone to the Stilt house tonight to ask that one simple question. No more. He just wanted the truth. He finally released his grip on Becca's purse, unzipping it and looking inside. It was her, this purse and its belongings. It was Becca, a piece of her. It carried her smell and her being. He pushed the contents around with his hand and found her lip balm on the bottom. Uncapping the tube, he closed his eyes and inhaled. He could still conjure in his mind the taste of this lip balm from the night he and Becca kissed. He pulled out her law school ID. Staring at Becca's image, he wanted to ask this girl he loved 1,000 more questions, wanted to rewind time and visit her again, make it a different ending. Finally, he threw the lip balm and ID back into the purse and dropped it onto the end table. Ripping open the envelope he had taken from the Stilt house, Brad unfolded the single page and immediately recognized her cursive. The letter was to Becca's unborn child. Brad's breaths were labored again as he read, his chest anvil-like. His eyes teared up as he sat on the couch and read the letter. The truck's headlights continued to pour through the open cabin door while he sat, rocking on the couch, back and forth, back and forth. Chapter 46. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake Foothills, March 15, 2012, Day 11. Ray grabbed Kelsey's wrist as she started into the cabin. "Where are you going?" Kelsey pointed with her other hand at the purse. "Come on, something's not right here." Together, the two walked into the cabin. Without the evening light, they were both cast in shadows. Kelsey picked up the purse from the end table and looked inside. She pulled out an ID badge, and there she was, Becca Eckersley, staring back at her. Kelsey could feel the stare, as though the photo taken long ago was a portal through which Becca spoke to her. She was asking for help, and Kelsey would not deny her. Ray was crouched over the coffee table now, staring at the scattered mess of photos and notes and school papers. Ray had seen Becca's face plastered in the paper and on television often enough to recognize her instantly. "Hey," Ray said, pointing at the table. She looked quickly around the cabin. "This is freaking me out." Kelsey glanced at the photos on the table, then held up Becca's law school ID. They both nodded at each other, not having to speak to let the other know her thoughts. Kelsey pulled out her phone and began to dial Commander Ferguson's number. She stopped mid-dial and looked at her phone. "What?" Ray said, whispering suddenly. "No service." "Let's get the hell out of here." Kelsey nodded, but then she saw the cellar door, cracked open and covered with photos. "Wait," she said. "Look." Against Ray's protests, Kelsey walked deeper into the cabin. An investigator to her marrow, Kelsey could not allow herself to leave. With a morbid fascination when one stares at a car wreck, Kelsey walked to the cellar door and pulled it open, marveling at the shrine that was there. Stuck to the back of the door and to the wall that followed the stairs to the basement were hundreds of photos of Becca, all pinned dutifully with a single thumbtack and curled at the edges. Most appeared to be from college, with campus or dorm room paraphernalia in the background. Some were staged photos from yearbooks. Others were cut and pasted, zoomed in to isolate Becca's face. A few were rectangles of only her eyes, staring out at nothing. Until now, Kelsey felt the stare again, accepted it. The notes were here too, farther down the wall. The short notes that started with a single B and ended the same way. Scores of them, tacked to the wall in a descending path that led to the basement. The stairs creaked as Kelsey took them, one at a time, staring at the photos and the notes as she descended into the basement. Halfway down the stairs, the dying light that spilled through the cabin's windows was gone, so Kelsey used her phone to highlight the wall. The flash reflected off the glossy photos. As Kelsey scanned the shrine, the pictures became hypnotic. Toward the bottom of the staircase, she came across more disturbing photos. Not of a young student posing and smiling for the camera, but of a young woman, unaware she was being photographed. In these shots, taken paparazzi style, Becca was walking through campus, removing items from her car, leaving a doctor's office. In several photos, Becca's image was blurred as she jogged with headphones dangling, hair in a ponytail. Kelsey stopped on these frames, the ones of Becca jogging. She ran her finger over one of the images, blocking from her mind those thoughts that tried to trespass. "Jesus Christ," Ray said, staring at the wall from several steps above Kelsey. She had come across several close-up prints of Becca sleeping, eyes closed, hair matted. Some were full-body shots of Becca in bed, covers pulled down to her feet, wearing a tank top and shorts. "Let's get the hell out of here." But Kelsey was too far gone. From her years on the beat, she understood the work of a disturbed man. More than that, she was fascinated by it. Kelsey tapped her phone and took pictures of the wall, of the photos and the notes, of the purse she still carried and the ID badge, of the cabin stairs and the way a deranged killer lives. She saw the privileged life of Brad Reynolds deteriorating before her, and in her mind, she wrote the story. "See," Kelsey said aloud, but she was clearly talking to herself. "He's an organized asocial." "Oh, really?" Ray said. "He's also a psychopath stalker. Now let's go." Kelsey was still snapping photos. "Stalker, yes. Psychopath, no." Kelsey slowly took the last two steps into the basement, videoing now as she moved slowly, trying to capture everything she could. "I see it all now. It's all come together in my mind. See, Brad loved Becca, but she didn't love him back. Becca loved Jack instead. Brad became obsessed." "Obviously." "No, it's more than that. It's more than an obsession. It's called organized asocial. It's the pattern of a killer, a particular type of killer. He's smart, high IQ smart, can be very personable and charismatic, but withdraws from society, holds himself up out here in the foothills where no one will bother him, breaks bonds with his family so he can concentrate on his prize. Then, with nothing else to distract him, his obsession grows. It happened right here in this cabin. Grew until it overtook him, until an image of Becca formed in his mind that never really existed. And this false image of her became his reality. These types of killers are unaware of their growing obsession. Until one day, with Becca's image constantly surrounding him and all the memories of their time together eating away at him, he decides to see her, to talk to her. That's what he told himself. He only went to talk. Went into that stilt house to ask her a question. But in reality, he went to kill her. To take her life so no one else could have her. Ray stayed in the middle of the stairway, refusing to venture beyond the safety of the open door a few steps away and the scant light that was there. Kelsey, still videoing, walked into the basement, her phone like a lone star in the dark sky. The beam lit up a workbench covered with tools Brad had used to create his shrine, scissors and straight-edged paper cutters, photos of Becca waiting to be cut and pasted, a Nikon camera resting in an open case, various lenses set to the side. Newspapers, too, were stacked on the workbench. Some were discarded on the floor, large squares missing from them. To the side of the workbench, Kelsey found the isolated articles. They chronicled Senator Milt Ward's plane crash. She snapped photos of them, but failed to make a connection. Against the adjacent wall was a small desk and chair. Kelsey played the light over the surface to find handwritten letters. She picked one up and held it close. "Dear Becca," was the heading. Then a page filled with incoherent sentences and half-thoughts. It was signed by Brad. There were 10 sealed envelopes, all addressed to Becca. Stamped and ready to be dropped in the mail, had Brad ever mustered the courage to do so, Kelsey guessed. Above the desk, tacked to the wall, were formal letters addressed to Brad. Kelsey took a closer look and realized they were rejection letters from Penn, Columbia, and Yale. She snapped photos of the letters. Then something else. Positioned perfectly in the middle of the desk was a white piece of paper. In ugly block lettering, a message was scrawled. "To those who come for me, may you know my hell and never escape this place and what waits for you here." Kelsey came back from that investigative place in her mind where she spent the last several minutes writing her article, seeing it clearly in the full arc from Becca's acceptance to GWU through her death, and all the events in between that brought her to the Stilt house just 4 weeks before. "Ray? Yes? We should get out of here." "Thank God. Come on," she called from the stairs. Before the words were out of her mouth, headlights from a truck flashed through the cabin's windows as it came down the narrow road out front. The lights spilled into the basement stairwell and lighted Ray's face. "Shit," Ray said. It came out like a scream. "What's wrong?" Kelsey asked, running to the stairs. "He's here." "Come down here," Kelsey said, grabbing Ray by the wrist and pulling her into the basement. Outside, the truck skidded to a stop on the gravel. Chapter 47. Brad Reynolds, Summit Lake Foothills, February 17, 2012, just after Becca's death. The night's events finally crashed down on him as he sat reading Becca's letter to her unborn child. Brad was helpless to stop his mind from replaying the image of his hands around her neck. Why had she thrown it in his face, her pregnancy? It was as though she couldn't wait to destroy him with it. God, he wanted to do it all again, go back and talk to her, ask her about the business law test, that was all. He sat for hours, with these thoughts spinning in his head, considering different scenarios of how things could have gone, of how it all could have worked out between him and Becca. But in the end, his visit to the Stilt house backfired. He had more questions now about the girl he loved than before he went. Married and pregnant, and nothing like the girl he loved. The rising sun caught him by surprise. It appeared suddenly, draining the blackness from the cabin windows and replacing it with a subtle glow. In one deep breath, Brad looked around the cabin and knew what he needed to do. It wouldn't be long. Someone would come for him. The police, maybe. His father, he hoped. And if it was his father, God help him, the man would finally get what he deserved. He took the entire day to prepare the cabin, spending most of it in the basement. He added final additions to his shrine, then set the cabin up so that anyone who entered would not soon leave. He set a trail of clues, starting at the front door. They were unmistakable, with Becca's purse as the first lure. It was sure to draw whoever came for him into the cabin, and if the purse pulled them in, The rest of the items would keep their attention. When he was finished, he climbed into his truck. It was early evening, and the sun was just starting to fade. He remembered the last year of his life. For 9 full months, he had been at his family's hunting cabin, alone and isolated, the way he wanted it. But every day was not the same. Yes, there was a routine he adopted that allowed him to stay warm and full and bathed. He gathered wood, chopped it, and fed the fireplace. He went to town when he needed food or supplies or propane. As the months passed, he developed an unwritten schedule to take care of his basic needs. But there was something else inside of him that needed tending. The temptation to see her could not always be contained. And when his longings spilled over, he took to the road. It was good to get away from the cabin. Therapeutic to see her. Of course, he always meant to confront her, to talk to her. But the sight of her always held him off. Instead, he became satisfied with simply photographing her, stealing her image and keeping it for himself. He had done this before. Jokingly, he told himself, when she slept in his bed. He always meant to share those photos with her, explain how beautiful she looked when she slept. But she broke his heart before this could happen. Becca, too, had a routine during the week, he found. Studying at the law library was one of them. And he knew when his cravings became too great, he could perch on a campus bench and wait for her to walk the path that led up the steps of the library. The photos he took then were easy. He simply blended in as another student. The ones he shot when she entered her apartment were more difficult, since these were through the windshield of his truck. And one night, not long ago, he was so close. Waiting for her around the corner of her apartment, hidden in darkness, he had almost earned the courage to step from the shadows and embrace her. Maybe things would have ended differently had he comforted her that cold, dark night. He had wanted so badly to hold her in his arms when she returned from the doctor. He was sure back then that she had fallen ill. And to think now about how worried he was by her frequent trips to the medical clinic, only to find she was pregnant. He thought again of the disgusting way she blurted it in his face. The sun was dying now as he sat in the truck, draining the cobalt from the sky as it melted again to black. It was irony, Brad thought, that such a beautiful day ended by turning to darkness. Staring at the fading sky, he knew no one would understand him. He could explain what he'd been through, tell the cops or his parents or the shrinks what Becca did to him, about Jack's betrayal, his law school rejections. He could detail it all piece by piece, and still, no one would understand him. He started his truck, put it in gear. He was finally ready to leave his cabin, leave it for those who had come for him. He pulled away, knowing he still had much to do to prepare, knowing that when he came back to this place, he would never leave. Chapter 48. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake Foothills, March 15, 2012. Day 11. The truck's lights were bright on the landing as Kelsey and Ray ran into the basement. Her phone was soon the only light in the darkened space. They searched for a place to hide and were ready to settle on a dingy closet before Kelsey saw it. "There," she said, pointing to the corner. She and Ray ran to the back of the basement, where three stairs led to a crawl space. 10 feet farther were coffin-like doors in the ceiling. They climbed the stairs and on all fours crawled through the cobweb-infested space. They both groaned as the silky webs broke across their faces. A truck door slammed outside, and footsteps pounded up the outside porch. "Go," Kelsey whispered, pushing Ray from behind. When they reached the doors, Kelsey held her phone while Ray fumbled with the sliding lock. She finally released it, and they both pushed open the double doors, finding themselves at the back of the cabin. They clambered out of the crawl space and into the dying evening light. As soon as they did, a rancid smell settled all around them. A sound, too, and identified at first, but after a few seconds, recognized as the buzzing of flies. thousands of them circling the shed at the edge of the property.
"What is it?" Ray asked, covering her mouth.
Inside the cabin, the front door burst open.
"Go,"
Kelsey said, and they both ran for the dark woods behind the property, shielding their noses from the rotten odor. Ray let out a short screech as their feet pounded gravel. As they approached the shed, the doors were wide open. The flies were heavy here, accumulating in dense swarms. The air was thick with rot. Kelsey slowed to a jog, Ray heading off in front of her. After a few strides, Kelsey stopped and stared. In the fading light, she saw the dark silhouette of a limp body hanging in the shed, the head propped up and slumped to the side like a twisty straw. Finally, she stopped, changed direction, and headed for the shed. Ray slowed also.
"Kelsey, come on!"
Ray was crying now, wanting to run and hide and get away from this haunted place. "Wait," Kelsey said, as she organized her thoughts and pieced together what she was witnessing. As she approached the shed, Kelsey realized what it all was and what it all meant. The cellar and the photos and his cryptic message. In front of her, Brad Reynolds' bloated and decaying body hung, unmoving, from the rafters. The noose cinched so tight around his neck that his eyes bulged like a thyroid patient from his sockets. His tongue fat and stiff, like a dried baguette had been shoved in his mouth. Flies feasting, maggots burrowing. Ray screamed when she saw the body. Kelsey quickly turned and hugged her, shielding her from the gore.
"Kelsey!"
a man yelled from the cabin. She recognized the voice. When she turned from the shed, she saw both Peter and Commander Ferguson, with his revolver drawn, bounding through the cabin's back door.
"Here!"
Kelsey yelled. Ray bent over and put her hands on her knees. Peter and the commander ran across the back lawn. Peter grabbed Kelsey in a tight hug.
"You okay?"
he asked.
"I'm fine. Just shaken up."
As Peter let go of her, Kelsey pointed to the shed.
"Oh, God,"
Peter said as he looked at the grisly scene. Still hunched over, Ray gagged and dry heaved. Peter crouched beside her.
"Breathe in and out." "Mr. Reynolds, I presume?"
Commander Ferguson replaced his gun with a flashlight that he played over the body and through the shed.
"That's my guess," Kelsey said,
covering her nose as she left Ray to Peter's attention.
"And pretty ripe. Wait until you see the basement of that cabin. Disturbing."
The beam of Commander Ferguson's flashlight fell to Brad Reynolds' feet and highlighted a note that rested on the ground. The commander reached into his pocket and produced a pair of thin rubber gloves, which he stretched over his fingers. He carefully lifted the note, thumb and index finger, and held it up to read. It hung sideways, and he tilted his head. It was three sentences.
"I only went to talk. I loved her. Despite everything she did."
Chapter 49. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake. March 18th, 2012. Day 14. She spent her last 3 days in Summit Lake, holed up in her third-story room at the Winchester. She gave one morning to Detective Madison, answering questions and giving details. Madison's boss had made his way to Summit Lake by then, the case having broken so fast and messy, and without the slick case solver having anything to do with it. Madison's questions, at first asked in a forceful and abrupt manner, soon mellowed, especially after his boss arrived. Every question Madison asked was one he himself had no answer to. The more he asked, the more clueless he looked. Kelsey gave a quiet smile and quick wink to Commander Ferguson when she left the station. He had been asked back as a special consultant to wrap up the Eckersley case. After the questioning, Kelsey stopped to see Ray at the coffee house. Still reeling from the night at the cabin and the scene in the shed, Ray was not her usual self.
"You going to be okay?"
Kelsey asked, as they sat in the overstuffed leather chairs and sipped lattes. Ray forced a smile.
"Just have to scrub that image from my mind, that's all."
"I'm sorry I dragged you to that cabin, Ray. I had no idea what we'd find. It's not your fault. I wanted to go and be part of this thing. Another smile. Got more than I bargained for, right? Kelsey smiled. Me too. She stared at her friend and confidant. I consider you a good friend, Ray. I hope you know that. I do, and I feel the same about you. Good. Once I get home and settled, I hope you'll come see me. Spend a weekend. I'll show you Miami. That'd be nice. Kelsey stood up. I've got to get going. I should write this up before it all leaks from my head. Yeah, Ray said, standing also. I've got to get back to work myself. It helps to stay busy. They looked at each other, then embraced in a long hug. Kelsey whispered into her ear, Thank you, Ray, for everything. Kelsey wrote the 3-piece article in long stretches, where time floated by without notice. Hunger never bothered her, and only occasionally did she have the urge to use the washroom. Kelsey never had trouble writing. Throughout her career, she was quite prolific with her articles and her book. She had zip drives full of ideas and outlines and stories that would likely never be published in any form of media. Putting words on paper was never a problem for her. But the 3 days spent at the Winchester after discovering Brad Reynolds' body were unique. She found herself in a zone she had only previously read about or heard about from snobby writers she knew who wrote novels and considered themselves elite. But now Kelsey finally understood that nirvana. She barely needed to think as she wrote Becca's story. The ugly draft she whipped up in Ray's apartment was trashed, and she started anew. After a beginning hook, capturing the essence of Becca's death and the terrible way this beautiful girl was killed, Kelsey captured Becca's early high school days in a short jaunt. George Washington University followed, and, with permission from Jack Covington's parents, Becca and Jack's love story found the page. Her friendship with Brad came next, and all the highs and lows of the group's senior year of college. She quoted Gail Moss extensively. The article followed Becca into law school and Jack into Milt Ward's campaign. That the two stories were related was astounding. And great luck, Penn Courtney had said. Kelsey chastised him for such a comment, but knew it was the truth. Kelsey chronicled Becca's secrets, as she knew she had to. They were, after all, the essence of the story. Her pregnancy, her relationships, her marriage. Kelsey wrapped things so tightly in the first 2 segments that anyone who read them would surely be waiting anxiously for the final installment. That third part, written in 1 sitting, covered Becca's impromptu visit to her family's stilt house in Summit Lake to study for her exam. There was some speculation, of course, but Kelsey was pretty sure she had things straight. She still had in her possession, after all, Becca's journal. Detective Madison didn't need to know everything. In fact, didn't deserve to. The town, so special to her now, was covered in a beautiful opening to her third piece. Kelsey even managed to quote 2 members of the gossip group, the heavyset woman and the 40-year-old. Then, the beginning of the end for Becca, the girl she felt so connected to. From Becca's arrival in Summit Lake, to her visit with Libby Houston, to her return home, Kelsey plotted her path to death. And from the other side, Brad's presence in the shadows, his life in the foothills, and his arrival at Stilt Row late that night. Of course there was no forced entry. Of course Becca allowed him into the house. They were once close friends, reunited on February 17th in a sad and tragic ending. The final night of Becca Eckersley's life flowed from her fingertips with no effort at all. Kelsey then chronicled her own 2 weeks in Summit Lake, concluding with her trek into the foothills and the morbid discovery at the hunting cabin. The photos from her cell phone were an added touch that would make the story. At 2:15 a.m., she stuck the entire 3 days of writing on a flash drive and emailed a copy to Penn Courtney. She pulled the cork from a bottle of Chardonnay and poured a glass, wandering out to the balcony. Summit Lake was asleep. Dark but for the light posts on the corners and St. Patrick's Church 5 blocks away, with its V-shaped lights blazing up its facade. She sat for 30 minutes, drinking wine, and remembering the life of Becca Eckersley. Chapter 50. Kelsey Castle, Greensboro, North Carolina, April 28, 2012, 2.5 months after Becca's death. He pulled into Raleigh-Durham International Airport at 4:18 p.m. She had landed 19 minutes earlier, and the timing was perfect. He took the lanes to arrivals, pulling to a stop at the United Terminal. Only a single loop around the airport was necessary to free himself from the traffic Nazi who hounded him. When he circled the second time, he saw her standing at the curb with her suitcase next to her. Peter rolled down the passenger side window as he approached.
"Welcome back to North Carolina," he said.
Kelsey smiled. "Look at you. I literally just walked out here." He shrugged.
"We've got good synergy. What do you want me to say?"
Peter climbed out, walked around the car, and engulfed her in a giant hug, then leaned back and kissed her cheek. Awkwardly, Kelsey turned in the middle of the gesture and their noses touched. She quickly kissed his lips. "Hi," she said. "Thanks for picking me up."
"I'm glad you came."
"Me too. You sure you don't mind a road trip?"
"Not at all. I like that you're including me."
Kelsey shrugged. "I couldn't have written the article without you. Figured I'd include you in this final adventure. Plus, I don't know how this will turn out, so I might need some muscle." Peter put her bag in the back. "Mind if I drive?" Kelsey asked. Peter wrinkled his brow.
"I guess not."
She held up the folder in hand. "I won't make you wait until it's printed. The whole story's here. I thought you could read it on the way." Peter took the folder.
"For sure."
The Eckersley article comprised 25 pages of white computer paper. As Kelsey drove, Peter read slowly and deliberately for 40 straight minutes, licking his finger with each page turn. Interruptions came only occasionally from Kelsey, who inquired about his facial expressions. She was always jittery watching someone read her work. When he finished, they discussed the article until they were on the outskirts of Greensboro. The road trip was Kelsey's final hurrah on the Eckersley article, and the very last bit of money Penn Courtney was going to allow Kelsey to expense. She had no qualms about taking advantage of it. This trip had everything to do with Becca Eckersley. They pulled into the parking lot of the Marriott in downtown Greensboro. At the front desk, they checked into separate rooms and wheeled their bags to the elevator. Peter pressed the button for the fifth floor, then looked at Kelsey. 3, she said. They stood in silence until the doors opened again on the third floor. Kelsey pulled her bag behind her as she exited the elevator, then turned around. "How long do you need?"
30 minutes, maybe."
"Meet you down there at 7?
"See you then."
Kelsey took half an hour to clean up. She fixed her makeup and primped her hair, changed into a casual dress, and swiped a streak of perfume across her neck. She took the elevator down to the lobby, where she found Peter waiting for her at the entrance of the hotel restaurant. He, too, had changed from his jeans and t-shirt into slacks and a sport coat with an open collar. Seated at a table in the back of the restaurant, they ordered a bottle of wine.
"I read your book," Peter said.
"Yeah?"
"Of course. You're a very talented writer."
"Hold on," Kelsey said, pretending to dial her phone. "Will you talk to my editor?"
"Please," Peter said. "I sense he feels the same way."
Without the pressure of the case over them, they talked easily for 2 hours. It was what they had hoped to achieve in Summit Lake, but never were able to. Now, sipping the last of the wine long after the table was cleared, they talked until they were the only ones left in the restaurant. Finally, noticing the waitress waiting in the corner, Peter paid the bill, and they walked to the lobby elevator. A big day awaited tomorrow. As the elevator doors closed, Peter pressed the button for the fifth floor.
"Where are you again?"
he asked. Kelsey smiled. "Same." The next morning, they had breakfast at a diner down the street and were back on the road by 9 a.m. It was approaching 10 a.m. when they reached the Greensboro suburbs and pulled to the large house with a manicured lawn. Tall trees in the front yard did not sprout branches until they were far above the roof, like southern pillars of protection. Kelsey sat with a manila envelope on her lap and stared at the intimidating front door. Peter rubbed her knee as she took deep breaths. Finally, she climbed from the car and walked up the steps, rang the bell. A petite, middle-aged woman answered the door.
"Mrs. Eckersley?"
Kelsey asked.
Yes. The woman wore a serious expression. I'm Mary Eckersley.
My name's Kelsey Castle. I'm from Events Magazine. There was a moment of silence between them. Mary Eckersley finally said,
I know who you are.
Sorry to show up unannounced, but I wanted to see you before my article runs.
And when will that be?
2 weeks.
We're not going to give you any statements for the article.
I understand, but that's not why I came. Mrs. Eckersley waited. I wanted you and your husband to know that this case, this thing, horrible thing, that happened to your daughter, has touched me in a way that no other story has. I know this will sound intrusive, but I feel connected in some small way to her. And it's important for you to know everything I wrote was with Becca in mind. With what she went through on the forefront of my thoughts as I wrote about her life and her death. Kelsey had a prepared speech. 2 full paragraphs she had written and rewritten, spoken aloud in the bathroom mirror, and committed to memory. It covered her own struggle with having been raped, her questions about life and death, and why one person lives through such a horrible event while another dies. It was beautiful and poignant, meant to disarm the Eckersleys and bring them safely onto her side. It was sincere, too, meant to show that there was nothing vindictive in what Kelsey had written. But when she saw William Eckersley walk up behind his wife, the entire speech leaked from her mind, leaving a giant black void that prevented thought. Kelsey smiled at him awkwardly. No introductions were needed. Anyway, Kelsey finally said, I came here to give you this. She handed Becca's mother a manila envelope. I think Becca would want you to have it. Kelsey slowly backed away from the front door, finally turning and walking down the steps. As Peter backed down the long driveway, Kelsey watched Mr. and Mrs. Eckersley handle the envelope, turn it over for any clues about what might be inside. Finally, they opened it and pulled out Becca's journal and the letter she wrote to her daughter. Kelsey caught Mrs. Eckersley's eyes as she looked up from the journal. Peter shifted the car into drive, and they pulled away. Chapter 51. Kelsey Castle, Miami, Florida, May 11th, 2012, 3 months after Becca's death. The morning sky was patchy with clouds as Kelsey left her house. She wore an Under Armour tank top and shorts. Tight ankle socks were invisible under her green running shoes. Jogging along the beach for a mile, she smelled the salty air as her body glistened from the humidity. It took 10 minutes until she came to her old turnoff, which she followed for another quarter mile to the edge of the forest. Her heart was racing. The mile run responsible for some of it, anxiety doing the rest. Staring into the forest, the path was shadowed and poked with sunlight trickling through the foliage. There were no other runners or bikers present. The thought of turning around crossed her mind, of taking the beach path back home. It would be a sufficient 2.5-mile run, but would completely defeat the purpose of this morning. It had been months since she ran this trail. 4 long months since she was last here, showing the police where it happened and how it happened. A lifetime since this journey began. And finally, with Becca's article debuting today, Kelsey was ready to end this chapter of her life, type the last sentence and ship it off. She felt a few raindrops splash her shoulders, then looked up to the sky. It was a mix of distant sun and overhead clouds. The rain grew heavier. She put in her earphones and took off along the shaded forest path, the thick foliage protecting her from the drizzle after a few strides. 7 minutes in, she passed the spot. She refused to look into the woods, refused to let her mind run wild. Instead, she ran right past, her long muscular legs propelling her beyond this part of the forest and her life, 1 foot in front of the other, until the spot was far behind her. 2 miles went by before she saw the exit up ahead, a curved doorway out of the forest. It was bright and alluring, calling her. She picked up her pace, lifted her knees in a high runner's gait, touching the path with just the balls of her feet. Her arms swung in a tight, controlled motion as sweat rolled down her wrists and across her open palms and flew from her fingertips. As Kelsey grew closer to the forest exit, she saw the pavement outside was covered in sunlight, reflecting off the puddles that had formed, highlighting the dripping trees. A sunny rainstorm. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Summit Lake by Charlie Donnelly, performed by Shannon McManus. Performance copyright 2015 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.